The Top 100 Clubhouse podcast is brought to you by Eden Mill, bringing the tradition of distilling whiskey and gin back to St Andrews, the home of golf. Rick Shields, in his most recent pod, one of his discussion points was he disagreed that Augusta was at 12 on our list. He believed it should have been higher. So I wanted to get two of the most experienced people in the top 100 ranks and raters to come on and understand how we go around our business and why we do what we do. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse, the ultimate podcast for golf course enthusiasts worldwide. I'm your host, James Henderson, and we're about to embark on a journey through lush fairways and breathtaking landscapes, as well as delving deep into the minds of fascinating individuals from every corner of the golfing universe. Get ready to explore the world's top golf courses through the eyes of those who know them best. Welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse podcast. I'm joined here by Greg Ollendorf and a very much friend of the pod, the CEO of Top 100, David Davis. Greg Ollendorf and David are both in the same club of very few of playing the top 100 golf courses in the world. Which list did you both do, Greg? Which one was yours?
I finished the 05 through the 13 golf magazine list.
And David, which one was yours?
Mine's the more later one. So like it's from now it's from 15 to 21, I want to say. And then with and that includes the top 100, our top 100 list as well, actually. Two of those, to be fair.
And so, Greg, I know for a fact that you've written a book on the subject as well, haven't you?
I did. It kind of a labor of love, I guess, because I not only did I do the golf magazine list, but I started out by chasing the Golf Week Top 100 Modern and Top 100 Classic. And when I finished the 200 courses from 2010, there are still to this day only three of us that have ever finished a Golf Week 100-100. So throw in 1,000 courses or more in all 50 states, that's kind of the story of my story.
So you're both very experienced raters of golf courses and have been all over the world and two of the great travelers of golf. Actually, Greg, just quickly on that note, which was your favorite list you did?
Oh, gosh, I focused on the 11 list. I mean, that's the one that was always like my target list. So I don't really know. I've looked at him to pick that. Was that the best list of the bunch? But it's, you know, you sort of adopt a child. That's the one that will always stick with me.
And over that time, there's been, since your, was it 05 list, there's been, what, 18 years? How's the list developed? How's the view on quality of golf changed?
The list has changed for sure. The most recent lists are turning to a real favor of Lynx golf, for sure. A lack of favor for some of the, maybe a few of the far-flung places that were hyped and so on. And we're going to talk about overhyped in a little bit, I'm sure. So the list is certainly evolving as time goes on.
Superb. Well, just to for everyone to understand why I got both of you here, and I just wanted to give a bit of clarification on why you two are the two people that I wanted to have on. Rick Shields, in his most recent pod, was talking about, well, actually Top 100 featured, which was very, very kind of a very nice man. I've met him a few times. He is a good guy and knows quite a lot about golf. But one of his discussion points was he disagreed that Augusta was at 12 on our list. He believed it should have been higher. He's played a couple of the golf courses. So I wanted to get two of the most experienced people in the top 100 ranks and raters to kind of come on and understand how we go around our business and why we do what we do. And one of the great understandings that people don't really get is the differential between experience versus just the golf course. And it's something that you guys are very proud of, being able to differentiate between the experience and the golf course. And I know, Greg, you've got a big list of about 9 things that are key to that, not overhyping, but do affect a decision-making on a golf course. So maybe the best way to start is if we start going through your 9, and David, join in whenever you want.
Yeah, I appreciate that, James. And again, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying that, you know, my premise of defining what great golf is, and I wrote about it in my book, was I think you have to, as a Raider or anybody that's looking at defining great golf, is, you know, it's got to be architecture based, because I'm a big architecture nut, but it's the first ball on the first peg on the first tee, and what happens from that moment until you pull the ball out of the cup on the 18th green. To me, that's the only thing that we can debate on the merit of how great the golf course is, not how great the golf experience is. I mean, there are some places on this planet that both David and I have played where, I mean, the experience was all world. I mean, you know, if you can, you know, throw in the, you know, the lodge at Loch Lomond and the bed I slept on there, if I could have stolen it in my suitcase, I would have taken it home. I mean, it was just, and there's a bottle of 12-year Macallan, you know, in the room that's just available. I mean, that's a great experience. I mean, how can you argue that, right? But I was traveling with a buddy of mine in New Zealand, and we were on one of the epic, you know, treks across those parts of the world. And we started to debate what possibly led to a golf course being overrated, you know, and so we did come up with a bit of a list, and I'll throw them out there, David, and you can fire at them all you'd like, but you know, and it's 8 or 9 ideas, but these were things that could potentially lead someone to maybe miss or overrate the experience or the hype or the whatever, more than just the grass between the first peg and the last ball. Okay. So you got to believe my premise. If you don't believe that, then you're not going to agree with anything that I probably say. But if you do believe that we're really rating the grass outside and what's going on there, then I think these things matter. Okay. So here are some things that can lead to a course maybe being inflated just a touch. Okay. A famous tour pro grew up there as a kid. You know, I mean, there's just a real risk that those golf courses tend to be a little inflated, right? Because so-and-so, and I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to, and by the way, there are some really good courses that tour pros grew up as a kid that deserve everything that they get. But there are some that, you know, probably are just a little heady on the lists and have been for a long time. You know, today, one of the nasty things that's going on in my mind is the overhype on social media. I mean, people are paying $150,000, $200,000 to join the greatest new course in rural Lord knows where. And they have 2 years or 3 years to hype it before anybody's even seen it. And it's great by definition. Well, it's great because you got a couple hundred grand in it, right? It has to be great. I mean, you can't say you joined a course for a couple hundred grand and not hype it up. You just have to. But we see those courses pop up on lists the first year that they're available. The Raiders fawn over them. And then they just dutifully fall off as time goes on, because most of the time, a lot of those courses really have not lived up to the hype. So that's a big deal. A course that has a couple of great signature holes, you know, oh my God, this particular hole on this course and that one hole, you know, sort of flows over to the other 17. Like if one's great, the rest of them are great, but maybe the course only has 3 great holes. Now they could be all world. I mean, there are some epic swings in this game on a couple of courses that you just literally would pay anything to just take that one swing, but it doesn't mean the whole course is great. So we have to be careful of that.
Do you mind me asking you a question about that?
Yeah, sure.
Just quickly, is there any golf course that you think is just that wouldn't be on a list and has never really been on a list that has an all world 3 holes or so that you just think, I wish this was somewhere else? Why not try Eden Mills The Guard Bridge Blended Malt Whiskey or Golf Gin? Visit our sponsor's site, www.edenmill.com, for more information. Eden Mills St. Andrews, bringing the art of distilling back to St. Andrews.
Oh, I wasn't prepared for that one.
Sorry.
I don't have one off the top of my head that, you know, that it suffers that, but there certainly are plenty of places that, you know, I mean, I hate signature hole. I mean, I just by definition hate the whole concept of a signature hole. I mean, when the starter tells you that, you know, the signature hole is number 12, I mean, does that mean the only thing that's important that day is going to be playing one hole of 4 hours, right? And by the way, the first 11 really are kind of just nothing. So until 12, I'm not even going to get the juices flowing. That doesn't make sense to me, right? So I think courses do themselves a disservice by naming a signature hole or a corner or, you know, an area or a whatever. So I don't have a particular one in mind. A couple of the others, courses by big bodies of water. there's no doubt that oceans have a massive influence on how good a golf course is. The sights on some courses that have popped up in the list recently are epic. Sometimes the ground isn't. Sometimes the ground isn't even suitable for golf. But boy, oh boy, the view and the par threes that are all stuck along the water are so darn good that the rest of the course must be good. You know, by the way, there are some really great courses along big bodies of water. So that is not a universal truth, but it certainly can be a negative influence in time. Courses that host big tournaments, you know, you see them on TV every year. You know, big tournaments have a big influence because people know them so well. So I got to play the course that the tour was just at. You know, the tour, unfortunately, is going to some really pretty unimaginative golf courses. I mean, the tour used to play some really great places. And, you know, there's a lot of courses the tour plays today that you wouldn't go out of your way to go play, but they're on TV. So, you know, that matters.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good one, Greg, if you don't mind us jumping in here and there on that. Because
no, please.
That one is massive, right? And if you're talking about literally people that are really into their golf courses and ranking and rating courses or whatever, they look at it different than 99.9% of the public does. And, you know, if you're a young person or somebody that's always aspired to play, you know, competitive golf or great golfer, you know, or golf to you is about the big tournaments and those type of things, then that sure makes perfect sense that's why, you know, you'd want to play those courses. That's what you're seeing all the time. When you watch your idols play and the pros play, they're playing on those type of courses. I mean, that one's massive out of your list. So I think that is, for the average golfer, the single biggest one, you know, wow, that challenges the pros, for example. You know, that's the greatest challenge in golf, or the greatest test of golf for the pros. I wholeheartedly believe that, you know, for people, and we'll get back to that point, because I think that's, you know, when Rick is looking at courses, I believe that's what he's looking at, you know, with his background. And that's not an insult. That's just, people look at it like that. All of Spain, for example, judges courses that way, literally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. And again, as the tour, you know, tour's about money, and, you know, they're going places that have big infrastructure potential and, you know, have been built tour, you know, friendly. Right. And so that's just different. They're serving up a product to bring 50,000 people on a piece of property. And, you know, it's tough to get 50,000 people on Marion. Well, you can't. Right. So it's just different. And that's OK. Again, and none of these are, I'm not saying any of these are right or wrong. I'm just saying these are factors. And just the last couple that I'll throw out, the more exclusive a club is, by definition, the greater it is. The one owner clubs, you know, get a tremendous amount of hype because you can't get on. So if you finally get on, are you going to say it's not any good? You know, and maybe it's good. There are some one owner clubs that are really good. There are some one owner clubs that are just abysmal. So, you know, that's an issue. And, you know, and the big name architect syndrome, you know, whether it's an old dead guy architect or the modern architects. And by the way, there's, you know, some of these guys have done some absolutely epic work, but just because architect X built or builds a golf course doesn't mean it's going to be epic. And a lot of that's got to do with budget. It's got to do with the site. You know, it's got to do with environmental reasons that they couldn't build where they wanted to. I mean, it doesn't mean the architect can't build a good golf course. We know that the great architect could build great golf courses. But, you know, Ross has got his name on 400 of them. And let's just suggest that all 400 aren't epic. But there are some that are epic, right? And even the modern guys, you know, the number of great sites available are dwindling. And, you know, I mean, there's been some courses forced onto some ground by a big name architect with a big budget that still don't work, you know, or don't live up to the hype. So, you know, that's just a random list of things that can have a tremendous impact on how people vote, you know, the lists. And I think some of those can really affect the outcome.
One thing I would like to go back on was talking about the difficulty of a golf course, where the pros like to play and where the pros are set up for the hardest tournaments. Yeah. And it goes back to the original list where you have the top 200 hardest was the first ever list, right?
Right.
So lists are developed from there, but it's really hard for people to understand. It's very easy for someone to understand this is the most difficult golf course, right? It's very easy for someone to understand that playing Oakmont is bloody impossible. Good luck holding your handicap there. And if you if anyone bet, anyone from Oakmont tries to take you on with a bet, don't take it.
Don't take it.
Never take it.
They're going to eat your lunch, man. Those guys know how to play that golf course are good. And by the way, I love Oakmont. So, I mean, yeah, it's one of the examples of a golf course that is super hard, okay? But I think it's super fair as well. I don't find Oakmont hard for hard's sake. But we, David and I, have definitely played a good couple handfuls of courses that are hard for hard's sake and completely are no fun. And I can't even imagine being a member there. Or can you imagine taking, you know, four of your good clients there, that they can get slaughtered for the day? You know, they can't make the forced carry. You know, I mean, they can't hold a green. They can't get out of a bunker. And it's hard. Hard isn't fun to me at all. I mean, hard is the antithesis of fun in most cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. It tends to be on the same scale, right? But the fact of the matter was, these rankings were very evidently put out by a group of probably ex-pros or high-end golfers who were deciding the golf game in the, was it 70s when they first put out the list? So how is the list developed? And because it's almost impossible for us to say why that's the, it's, we can describe it, why it's the best, but it's very easy to say what the hardest is, but it's very hard to say why that is the best versus something else. Why something would be better than another course, because it's almost not got a, it's not quantified.
There's a couple of points there that immediately spring to mind, James. One is that, you know, and we're talking about ranking and rating things. It's subjective. So, and that all starts with what's your criteria? You know, we can come up with any criteria we want. We can use, you know, not, I don't want to pick on Golf Digest, but we can use Golf Digest criteria. If we use their criteria and Greg and I go around and we do our rankings and ratings on their criteria, we come up with a different, you know, a different set of courses. Otherwise, we're not actually using their criteria, right? You know, they just have different, you know, different points that are awarded differently. So like, for example, if we're ranking and one of the most important things in that ranking is maintenance, well, the top 100 golf courses in the world might be in the U.S. For sure, because, you know, they have the highest membership fees in the U.S. They have the, you know, the highest green fees for people that are going to pay, generally speaking, right, across the board. So that means they have more money to put into maintenance. And if that's your key, fast greens, if that's the most important thing for you, then that's going to change our ranking. We're going to look at it and go like, hey, that's totally different. And that's the same thing if we say, what's the most difficult course or which one is the best test of golf? Because first of all, test of golf, what does that mean? How do we define that? Is that test of golf for a pro or is that test of golf for a hack like me? So do you know what I mean? If I compare, I can't compare those two things. So if the average ideal of a great course is what's a test of golf for a pro, honestly, there's no way that I could, I can't relate to that because I don't know unless I've been playing with pros all the time and I can see that that's how a pro plays and that's what they look for and that's how they think about it. Yeah, I mean, that for me, that's totally different. And I don't look at like pro golf. They're great players. It's another game. It's another world. I might as well be driving my, you know, my little BMW down the road and comparing that to Formula One and saying, what's the best racetrack in the world? I can't because I'm not driving it to 250 miles an hour.
But no, but one of the great, sorry, on you go, Greg.
No, I was just going to add on to that a little bit. And I think David's so spot on with, you know, what are you really defining? What, you know, what really matters, right? And there's so much hype on, you know, the great holes and whatever. And one of the things I like to do in defining what great is, you know, I know what the greatest hole in the course is. Everybody knows what the greatest hole in the course is, right? It's a signature hole. We've all been talking about it. I want to think about what the worst holes are, you know, and how many of them are there? You know, if there are no bad holes, we're on the way to getting moving up the ranking list, right? If there's a nine or a stretch of six or seven holes that are just completely mundane, I mean, that's got to have an influence, right? Because we're playing 18 of them. Right. So if we throw five or six off because they just were nothing, the other 12, I mean, how great do they have to be to raise the average of the whole thing up to a point where it makes any sense? So there's just a variety of ways to think about it. And you're right. It just depends on who you're rating for and what their, you know, resistance to scoring. You know, what is resistance to scoring? I mean, I go out there and I, you know, if I'm a five handicap and I shoot 92, that's a great golf course because you just bludgeoned me.
I know that too well.
Feel that way when I walk off. That may not feel like a great golf course to me. But what I shoot shouldn't matter. So talking about resistance to scoring shouldn't matter.
I completely agree. And there's one thing that I remember never really when I was young enjoying the old course that much. And I played there with my old father who only hit the ball 180 yards, you know. And I remember, and he was off 18. And I remember him on that day beating me out off four and thinking, is this what makes a great golf course? When I'm like 18, I'm just getting pumped by my dad. And I'm like, is this what makes a great golf course? When a golf course is playable for all. And I thought that was a really, that's one of the cool things I experienced at St. Andrews. And I think St. Andrews is very good for. And a lot of people don't think about when they're rating a golf course.
James, this is childhood trauma time. That's very clear.
If I start crying, just it's
an entirely different problem.
I think it's the only time he ever beat me as well. It's traumatic.
Nice place to be.
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate to have played there a couple of times. Okay, let's start with one thing I don't know if you mentioned in your list. I tried to write them down, but I kind of got caught up in a couple of them. Was if you're standing on the first tee at St. Andrews or the first tee at Augusta, there's very few, if not no other place in the world where you'll have a higher, almost, I want to say, intrepid nervousness about you than those two spaces in golf. How do you get rid of that?
First tee at Marion, when they stop clanking their dishes, eating lunch, can be a little bit nerve-wracking too. But there are only a couple places that affect you quite like that.
Yeah.
It's almost like an outer embodied experience for you guys because you're taking away all this amazing experience factor from the golf course and reviewing the golf course without that.
I mean, just quickly, James, I don't know anybody. Greg, maybe you're able to do that, or maybe you played many times, but I don't know anybody who can, you know, go to, well, first of all, you've been thinking about something probably for years or your whole life or whatever, and then you finally get an opportunity to stand on the first tee at the old course, for example, and they call your name out. And if it wasn't bad enough, now everybody knows who you are, right? And then you got a hit in front of Joe Public. You don't even know who's in the public, but there's 500 people walking around with their dogs and stuff, right? And they're all behind you.
Thank God it's a 5-iron, David. I mean, God it's a 5-iron at the old course, right?
Yeah.
Because you can bang a 5-iron down that fairway and still get to the green. And it's a really good thing to do.
Yeah. But what I was just going to say is nobody does that like consciously as a rater. Nobody goes there and says, "Oh, I'm going to rate the old course." You know, like so. I just don't buy that if somebody said that unless they've seen it, like you. If you've seen it, you know, 100 times, which I imagine you have, then you could go out and really like introspectively walk around it in great detail and say, like, you know what, the allure is kind of gone for me because I've played it so many times and I understand and I know the course really well. Sure, you could get over that. If you do Augusta, the same thing. Nobody I've ever heard of told me that they stood on the first tee at Augusta and all of a sudden everything was quiet and they could just focus on, you know, evaluating the course. Well, yeah, if you probably played it a few times and you got over the thrill of the anticipation of being there and how special all that those things are, maybe.
It's one of the hardest. I mean, the first ball at Augusta is the beyond. I mean, nerve-wracking doesn't describe it. You're praying to God that you make contact with the front of the club. I mean, you know, I mean, you feel like you're going to wet yourself. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But it is the hype and the allure and the anticipation is so ridiculous that, I mean, it's all you can do to pull the club back. And that's hard. It's hard then to say what I'm going to do next, you know, is all about, you know, is one a good hole or not. I mean, that's tough. I mean, you got to get a little into it before you can probably switch that off. I agree. You'd have to play it a dozen times before and with the same buddies and same caddies. And it's just a lark and we just had lunch and it's all good. But you know, for the one timers, it's pretty heady.
Well, that's it. There's not that many people who've played Augusta full stop. But there won't be that many. Imagine the number that have only played it twice or more, right? It's Yeah. It's a very small.
The guys that I know that have played it multiple times have played it 25 or 50. The guys that I know that have played it once outnumber the rest of it by a gazillion. Very rarely will I run into a guy that said I played it twice. You know, it's one or you're a regular. I mean, it's really David. That's my experience. I don't know about you, but that
100%. I agree 100%. And I guess one other thing that I would say, I feel like that's something where I'm just a little bit different because I didn't. You know, I was late to golf, so I didn't grow up like dreaming about Augusta, and I didn't watch tournament golf. I didn't care that much. That came later that I'd watch some of it, but that's a different than maybe you're different, Greg, that you kind of like grew up with these things, and maybe you've had golf in your family all the time.
We played it on Nintendo, whatever module it came out the first time. I mean, 8 million times. I mean, if I had a dollar for every ball I hit on Augusta, not on Augusta, you know, I'd be a wealthy man. So we grew up, you know, with the music and the spring and the flowers and the, you know, the first time we walked a practice round or whatever. I mean, it's ethereal. It's just no two ways about it. Its experiential factor is literally off the chart, and it has to be, right? But I did grow up knowing that I'd never play it and, you know, dreaming about it every day. And when I got to 99 of the world and 199 of the golf week lists, you know, and I had started working on my book. My working title at that time was 199 Ain't Bad, because I figured there's no way in heck I'm ever going to play the 200th, right?
Okay, so we have something in common. I'm gathering from what you just said. So your last one, number 100, was Augusta.
Yeah, number 100, number 200 in the golf week was Augusta.
How cool is that? And, so mine was, I was the same. So number 100 was
Augusta.
And
it is for most, it is for a lot of guys. But, you know, you know, when I got to Global Golf Travels for my book title, that was when I finally been able to write chapter 19. And chapter 19 was Augusta National. But, I mean, the book was over. I mean, I had basically written the manuscript and basically knew that there was no chapter 19, you know. And that's, and then fortunately for a lot of our friends, we've got a lot of friends that are at 99 too. And, you know, my heart bleeds for those guys. I mean, people ask, you know, how hard is it? You know, what's the hardest course? And it's Augusta National by 1,000 times over the next hardest. It's not even, and that's an understatement. It's harder than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of the allure of it, right? That's why almost every single person who's not in that chase or anything, right? If they just think about golf, they're always, you know, there's this mystique around it. You can't ask to go there. It's super private. Guys like, you know, whoever, names Bill Gates, that type of thing, right? I mean, not that I associate him with a golfer, but anyway, there's a long history of those type of people and, you know, business icons and whatever that are members there. And so you think, oh, well, when's Bill Gates going to call me up and invite me to come out for a game, right? Probably not happening too quick.
By the way, God bless them, right? They don't have to come out and invite any one of us for a game, you know? And people sometimes get a little testy with Augusta that, you know, people can't play it. My God, it's their golf course. I mean, they can let anybody play it they want and let no one play it if they don't want. I mean, right? Why? That's not to be upset about. I mean, just because I can't get on it doesn't make it a bad place. I mean, it just is what it is. So, but when it's on TV every year and, you know, the green jacket, it's the only major that goes back to the same site. I mean, there are a million factors that, you know, put it in its different place. I mean, it's like almost, it's a list of its own. I mean, it's, you know, greatest experience in the world. Wow. You know, it's hard to
ask. So I didn't have any issue at the first tee, believe it or not. I was nervous going down Magnolia Lane because I always said, I'll believe it once I'm driving down Magnolia Lane and there's not flashing lights from a police car behind me.
100%, right?
100%. And so I was nervous. I drove down Magnolia Lane with my friends that played with me in the car. And that was nerve-wracking. And then when I got to the first tee, I stood on the first tee, to be honest, and it was like November-ish. So if anybody watched that Masters, it was in November. Then you'd know it looks totally different than probably, Greg, when you played it, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I played it right after the turn.
Very, very green and kind of, you know, in a wet period, so a little bit wet. And I stood on the first tee and I was like, that is so weird. There's no fairway. There's no stands. There's nothing to define what I'm doing here. So, you know, I'll hit it to the left of that bunker on the right side, I guess. And it was like a mile wide. So that was a... you know, where you, it feels like you, yours was an ultra high moment. Mine was almost a letdown, a busy day, crazy busy day.
And we were told that we were going to play the nine holer first. So we went to the range and, you know, you're trying to get the blood pressure down and the pulse down. And I said, well, this is perfect, right? I can go to the range. I'm going to bat around some nine iron, some wedges. We're going to go play the little course. I'll be just right there. And so we're heading over to the par three course. And somebody from the club walked up to my host and said, oh, by the way, things have changed. You guys are going to one. I had hit driver. I had not swung a driver. Okay. So I had a honed in 135 yard nine iron that I was ready to hit on the par three course. And now we're going to one and I got a hit driver, which hasn't been swung yet. That was, and I mean, these are first world problems. I don't mean to make it any better than it was, but you know, that driver was the toughest driver I've ever pulled away from the ball before. There's just no two ways about it.
So before we get into talking fully about Augusta, there's a larger picture when rating a place like Augusta, because there's no doubt that Augusta is probably one of, if not the most beautifully kept golf course in the world, and its conditioning is perfect.
There's nothing that compares.
Yeah. Now, why do we have a golf course like St. Andrews that has 47,000 rounds a year or something on it? So it's impossible to keep it in the condition that somewhere like Augusta. How important is conditioning? And we have it above it in the rankings. How important is conditioning to a golf course rankings, particularly for top 100, where it's more architectural based?
Doesn't mean a thing to me. The only time condition matters is when a golf course has literally been let go, you know, or it's been built poorly where, you know, you've got nothing but catch swales all over the place because the course doesn't drain. So the only way they can drain it is by mounding it down to a catch basin. And the ball is always within 3 feet of the catch basin and it's always wet there and it's divoted to heck because that's the only place the ball can stop. You know, so you've built something that doesn't condition nicely and so on. But David, I don't know if I play a lot at Pinehurst and, you know, I love playing Pinehurst dormant in the winter. And there can be a lot of divots out there because the Bermuda isn't growing back, right? It is now, but it's not always. And I could care less. It plays beautifully dormant with divots and who cares, right? So I'm not hung up on it's got to be perfect.
Yeah. And I echo that like 100%. I mean, I live in continental Europe, as a lot of people will know. You know, we are a step below the UK, even in terms of like greenkeeping on average. I'm talking on average, right? Of course, there's courses that are, you know, literally almost perfect. But, you know, it's amazing if you talk about conditioning that you can go to the UK to some place that has, you know, one greenkeeper and a whole bunch of sheep. And, you know, you go out and you go like, wow, this is actually, it's really good. The putts somehow roll straight, even though it might not be rolling 15 on the stimp or whatever. And you think, hey, this is really good. How do you compare that with, you know, they have a budget of 25,000 pounds a year to maintain that course. And, you know, and sheep are expensive, right? And then you compare that to the U.S. or someplace, and I'm picking on the U.S., right? As Americans, I hope we can do that and get away with it. You know, if it costs you 50 grand a year to be a member and they've got 150 members and they imagine their maintenance budget, right? And the members, if the greens don't read on the board that they're rolling at 12 plus on a day, the members will be literally embarrassed to bring their friends out. It'll be like, oh God, we can't go out today. It's a 10 and a half or it's an 11. You know, that's the maintenance thing, but how do you compare it?
You know, you think about your sheep. I love the sheep, right? You go to Broa, you know, north of Dorna.
Yeah.
And the sheep and the cattle on the golf course with little electric fences around the greens. I mean, I don't care what condition Broa is in. And by the way, Broa generally is in pretty decent condition, but given what they're doing out there, you know, I watched a greenskeeper at Golspie just down the road with a regular cart with a drag behind. They had just sanded the greens and he is driving over the greens with a regular golf cart with a drag that you would have used on a baseball field in middle America, just almost on two wheels. And that's how he could maintain his greens. It's all the equipment that they had. And you know what? Still had just a wonderful time. So there's, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, it's golf, you know, go to Askernish, you know, go out to the island of Benbecula and go play Askernish where, you know, there's weeds in the fairway. And you know what? It's a riot. It's just a riot. So we got to get over the, you know, we got to get over the over manicured. And I think we are. I think the game is moving away from hyper manicured conditioning as being the definition of great. I think 20 years ago, we'd be having a different conversation, but I think we're moving in the right direction generally.
Yeah. Okay. So that's going to bring up an interesting point. I'm just going to hit on it very quickly because, and I'm just going to ask a question. I have my opinion, obviously, but how does, look, if we take Augusta as the poster child for where everybody wants to play, and we just said it's the best maintained golf course on the planet, and if it's not, it's in the 1%, right? Or the 0.01%. What does that say to golf? What does that do for golf in general? Not just ranking and ratings, but, you know, the Augusta effect, that it is something for a reason.
David, it had a massive effect. I believe, again, 20, 25, 30 years ago, the Augusta effect was unbelievably expensive for the game of golf. I mean, clubs all over the world, especially in the United States, right, were heavily influenced by, you know, what was going on in Georgia. There's no two ways about it. And by the way, not their fault. I mean, they just had the ability to maintain it at that level, and God bless them for that, right? I have no issue. But I think the movement to the more, you know, firm and fast sites, the sandy sites, the grasses that we grow on them, you know, you can't get fescue to look like that. I mean, a lot of places have a hard time getting fescue to grow. So let's just start with, we get the fescue to grow, you know, or fescue greens that are just always going to be different. But there's so many courses being built on that model now that I think we are away from the, you know, the absolute influence that Augusta, accidentally had on the game again a couple of decades ago. So I just don't think it's the problem that it was. And I think golfers are far more used to, you know, the blowout bunker, you know, that there may not even be a rake, you know, kind of kick it back. And, you know, COVID, by the way, had a big influence on that too, because nobody raked anything for how long. And we sort of got used to, yeah, we make it a crappy lie in a bunker, I guess it's okay. So yeah. I don't think we're as hammered by, you know, it has to be perfectly verdant green, you know, every day anymore.
Yeah. So, well, so back, going back, sorry, James, just
no, on you go. Sorry. It's really interesting.
Sorry, James. We're not interesting, are we?
I think this is what I wanted.
Yeah. So I'm just going to jump back to Rick Shields and his comments. So I'm going to go out on a limb. Look, he seems like a wonderful guy, but he identified himself. I haven't really seen that many courses. The big question is, does he fit that role where Augusta still, maybe is he still in that space where Augusta being perfectly maintained is the penultimate experience partially because of that, right? A, tournament golf, great test of golf, super fast greens, perfectly maintained.
Could be, you know, I don't know the gentleman, so I can't speak to what, you know, where his perspective comes from. And I think there are, you know, I mean, ask the average retail golfer, who are, you know, generally just tremendously great people, and you could play almost anywhere. I mean, literally almost anywhere, and ask them what they thought of the golf course when they walked out. And they said it was great. What they're defining is we had a great time. The people I played with, maybe I played well, maybe I didn't, you know, got a couple beers at the turn. They were outside. I'm not at work. The definition of that day is great, and they're right. And I'm really happy for those people. I really, really love it when I hear somebody wax poetically about a course that, you know, the snobs like us would just completely, you know, wash aside. And they love it, right? But I have to say, I mean, I've played over 1,000. And so I've played a lot of golf courses that fall into both camps, you know, immaculate or great by whatever definition, or mundane, but still a tremendously good time. And the fun thing about golf that makes it such a wonderful sport, you know, the two things that I think make it such a wonderful sport is, number one, it's not bowling, because every bowling alley, once you figure out the oil pattern, the good bowlers know to drop it on the fourth board, the fifth board, the sixth board, and they're going to bury it. I mean, and they just know it, right? So once you figure that out, that's the only challenge of the day. in golf is, of course, you know, we've got 8 million different kinds of type of properties. We got different weather. Every lie is different. Every day is different. You know, that's great. And the other wonderful thing is you can play it from cradle to grave, right? I mean, one of my greatest days ever was I played at Monterey Peninsula Country Club, the short course, and I had a hard time getting on. And finally, I got offered the chance to play. And my host was a 90-year-old lady. And my son was 18 and he was with me and I was 45. So I call it on the nines. And Barbara was just one of the most wonderful people I've ever played golf with in my entire life. And, you know, she hit it down the middle and we had a riot, right? But what other sport can you go out and have an 18-year-old, a 45-year-old and a 90-year-old enjoy the same playing field on the same day? There's no other answer to that question other than golf. So whether it's great or not great, the definition of great is the day with Barbara was great. And my greatest regret in life is when she asked me after playing the shore, she said, you know, Greg, I don't play 36 anymore, but we have a second course called the Dunes. And I said, of course, I knew that. And she said, I'd love to host you. And unfortunately, we were leaving that day. And my greatest regret in the world, and this is, you know, some years ago, and I assume Barbara's probably gone by now, but my greatest regret in the world is not flying back to SFO the next weekend and driving down and taking Barbara up on her opportunity to play the Dunes. I mean, that's just literally my greatest regret in the game. But where else can you do that? So, you know, great can be anything. But the day with Barbara was great.
Yeah.
So I've been through conditioning. We've been through difficulty as two factors that really shouldn't matter when rating a golf course. And there are two conditions. There's a third condition, I believe, that inspires tournament golf more than probably the other two is beautification. And we've been through the fact that it's cost a lot of clubs the Augusta effect of beautifying the course, right? To have the perfect condition, the beautiful setting. Now, I know Jasper Value 18 has put an amazing article together about the development of the golf course at Augusta. Yeah. And I don't know if you've seen it, Greg. It's an amazing article of Mackenzie and Jones and then how it's developed to be where it is today.
It literally tracks every, I mean, there's a lot of research that went into that, but tracks every change that's been made by which architect and stuff like that, you know? So the entire,
you know, and we'll tag it in all the socials and all the everything. Yeah. And it doesn't, but how much of the changes, Greg, I'll ask David this, but how much of the changes within those years have been driven by the Masters rather than making a better golf course?
I mean, I would say if you start at 1950, probably all of them. But again, that's a guess. And I have read through the article. That's whatever you want to call that. I don't know if it's an article. It's quite in depth and quite long. So
I'd just like to go back and start by saying it doesn't mean it hasn't become a better golf course, but it's just to understand the driving force behind the changes within the golf course.
Yeah, I mean, this day and age, or the last 20 years, I would guess that they are 100% all related to the Masters. Maybe that goes back longer, but again, I'm guessing. I don't know the history of the Masters well enough to go back to 1950 and say that. But when I read through the article, a lot of changes started happening in what I believe Greg and I would probably call the dark ages of golf course architecture, when, you know, they made everything lush and green and pretty. They tightened all the fairways tremendously. They grew trees everywhere that kind of suffocated the turf and the surrounds and those type of things, right? That they were looking at a different golf should be penal and hard. And, you know, Augusta was affected by that period as well.
If you think about where some of the great golf is, clearly, you know, is, you know, in the UK. And, you know, it's the antithesis of all of that, right? No trees anywhere, you know, color doesn't matter. It's wind and all the fun things that make golf different every single day, right? So I think it just depends on what you want. If you were selling, you know, that period of time where, you know, golf was used to sell real estate lots, You know, I mean, you know, we all know this. This isn't revolutionary information. But if you were selling $100,000 lots along a fairway, you know, you had to take up as much or take as little for the golf course as you could because the ground was far more valuable, right? And everybody wanted to look out in their backyard and see something pretty. So golf was a vehicle to sell real estate for a couple of decades. You know, today, most of the new courses, that's not what's going on, right? I mean, the golf courses are being built in places where there isn't a house within sometimes 20 miles.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm right in saying that the reason Jones picked Alistair McKenzie was because he went up to Pastiempo and saw the fact that what he was doing there with the trails, the tennis, and all the houses around the estate. And he was actually wanting to do that at Augusta. So, and wasn't able to do that because of the fact that the Great Depression happened when they were building the course. So interestingly, the original plan for Augusta was to be like that. One of the original concepts for it, but the things changed, right? And one of the interesting things I read recently about Augusta was the fact that it only ever had to start off with 22 bunkers. And the reason was because it was built in the Great Depression. And it meant that course maintenance was low. And Augusta is very open about the fact that they didn't have, it was struggling when it first started. They couldn't pay off their contractors. They, they're not quite the same now with the amazing tournaments they throw, but
times have changed. But you know, a sandwich is still a buck and a half, so you got to give those guys a lot of credit. I mean, you know, you could charge $42 for a sandwich, and they would sell the same.
They create the best viewing experience. That's why they're patrons, right? They create the best viewing experience in golf.
It's different,
but it's interesting to watch the development of it as a golf course. And
you know, don't want to be too controversial about it, but if you read through Jasper's his work, you know, at Value 18 on Augusta, I mean, the only conclusion you can come to at the end of that is that it's actually not the course that that Jones and McKenzie built. You know, every single hole has been changed. I think that off the top of my head, the third hole, Flowering Peach, that's the least changed hole on the entire course. So that's amazing if you think about it. Even the routing changed. So like everything changed from what was the initial intention of the people that built it, you know, and that's a pretty, you know, that I won't say that's negative or positive, but if you're a purist, that's negative, right? I mean, it's plain and simple. You wouldn't like that. But and if you're just a lover of Alistair McKenzie, well, I got news for you. Outside of a bit of a bit of the rooting, it's not an Alistair McKenzie course anymore. I'm sorry, I could be struck down for saying that, but it's not. You know, it's a course that is a hybrid, like many courses, but it's a hybrid of, you know, these guys, Tom Fazio, Robert Trent Jones, and Nelson. Everybody else. Exactly, everybody else that's been working on it over the years. I mean, it's much more. A modern Parkland course than it is
they've said we're going to change this thing as time needs to change it. Right. I mean, they've admitted that that's fine and it's fine. Right. I mean, you know, I mean, there are some courses that, you know, the goal in life is to make it as absolutely original as it ever was. And members are happy with that, but they're not hosting a tournament where guys hit the ball 350 yards in the air.
Exactly. And do you think there's something, well, in that, do you think there's something in that? And the fact that so the golf courses that are in the top 10, they host US Opens and they host, the Open, the British Open. But places like Cyprus and Pine Valley, the best two golf courses in the world, and I don't think that's in debate. I know, Greg, you're a big Pine Valley guy.
It's hard not to be. I mean, if we're really talking about what's great about golf, like I say, I like to think about it backwards. And what's the worst hole in the golf course? Pine Valley doesn't have a good golf hole. They only have great golf holes. I mean, there's not a weak swing, a weak anything on that entire property. And there's no other course in the world. And I know David has maybe a little different in his ranking, but there's no other course in the world that has 18 great or better holes. There just isn't.
What's the least good hole at Pine Valley?
The least good hole at Pine Valley? It used to be 12, right? But I mean, it's not true anymore. They've changed the hole and it's great now. So there's no bad hole in the golf course. There's no good hole in the golf course. So, you know, Pine Valley sits in its own space, but also Pine Valley doesn't host a tournament, you know, so except the Crump Cup, right? So right. It doesn't. And I played it. The last time I played it was the day before the Crump Cup. I mean, the place was on fire. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, you know, Greg, who's not a horrible bad player, would have had a tough time getting the ball in the hole under 100 that day, as tough as that golf course was that day. I mean, that golf course can be brutal, but they don't have to, they don't host anything where on any given day, it has to be, you know, on the 5th of April, it has to be this. And it doesn't have to be, right? It can be anything it wants to be on any given day. And the members enjoy it. And God bless them, right? I mean, there's just nothing better than having a great golf course that the members enjoy. You know, well, that's really what it's about.
There's quite a few global architects who are members at Pine Valley because of the appreciation for the quality that is there. Yeah. And what's interesting about it is our top three, if we include RCD, are all three courses that actually don't host tournaments. They're not interested, except for the fact that people are going to get a real interesting experience when RCD hosts the Irish Open coming up.
Yeah,
because it's a golf course that hasn't been built for it's correct. Not been changed over the years for tournament golf like the other two. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to be doing a bit of press stuff there, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. But it's a golf course that is so well considered. I know, David, it's one of your favorites. Mm-hmm. I know we've got a Dornick member here, so we better be careful.
I'm a Dornick homer. I get all that. I mean, RCD's front nine is epic. If RCD's back nine was as good as his front nine, we'd be having an argument with Pine Valley. I mean, you know, the ground in the front nine of Royal County Down is just, it's indescribable. You know, I mean, it is that good. There are a few weaker holes on the backside. But, you know, if that property would have been enough to put 18 holes on, I mean, we would literally be talking about it being potentially the greatest golf course ever imagined. I mean, it's just the front nine is that good. So I don't take a lot away from Royal County Down. I do give a lot of credit to my good friends at Royal Dornick because I mean, it's a pretty special place too. But I mean, we're splitting hairs when we're talking about courses in the top 10 or 12. You know, those are pretty darn good golf courses. And when we're trying to, you know, other than what, again, I think is the natural number one, when we're going to split the next up, you could take that next 8, 9, or 10, put the names on a piece of paper, toss it up in the air, let them fall, and have a fairly decent argument that however order you pick them up, you could probably make a fairly strong argument that it's not wrong. Because those next set of courses are really darn special.
So that's why I was asking. So I know it's R3, and because I know a lot of rating companies will do a top three as a you don't actually have to number them. You'd put a groupings, right? Mm-hmm. And so those three regularly come out as top three. Why would those three be better than the other golf courses below it? Is it, as you say, there's no bad holes? Is it we've been through the fact that it's not beautification, it's not condition, it's not difficulty. So what is it that defines those golf courses that's better than somewhere like Augusta, somewhere like Marion, wherever?
You know, we're splitting hairs sometimes. I mean, those are really the top handful are really great golf courses, right? And I think sometimes beauty's in the eye of the beholder. You know, there's a little blonde brunette, redhead kind of thing. You know, what's your favorite, right? I mean, so I when you're talking about those upper echelon golf courses, I mean, you can make, like I say, you can make a lot of argument that, you know, you could reshuffle them a little bit and it would be okay. But I mean, there are some special things about, you know, about Pine Valley and Cypress and Royal County Down and a number of the next ones that, you know, the sites are special, right? I mean, they're just tremendously special. You know, the views, you know, the shot at 16 at Cypress. I mean, come on. I mean, three wood in your hands and you're throwing it out into the ocean. I mean, there's no other place on the planet where you hit three wood into the ocean. I mean, that hole is absolutely unique. There's no hole anywhere else. There's a lot of holes along the water where you hit 8 irons over the ocean, you know, but you don't hit three woods over the ocean anywhere. you know? So, I mean, there's some special stuff about that. I mean, when you're coming back in on County Down and looking at Sleeve Donard, you know, on the way in, I mean, is that not a setting and a half? I mean, there's something special, and the golf holes are darn good too. So, you know, I argue that it's first ball on the tee, last ball out of the cup, but the settings of some of those places, you know, certainly amplify what was built on the ground. And when you combine those two things and it already is good golf, and then it's in a just tremendously great setting, that's why they're special.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I echo that as well. I guess the thing for me is that the greatest courses have started on arguably the best land for golf that's been utilized ever. So, yes. You know, so basically what happened was that architects went there and it was on them to either make or break, but you know, that's a losing battle. That's a match that you should be winning, right? Mm-hmm. And hitting a home run. And it just so happens that on those courses, they hit home runs.
Yeah.
So,
and it's true, because I mean, you don't get pieces like that anymore. I mean, you know, yeah. Environmentally, you know, the property's been used for something else. It's condos, you know, whatever, right? You don't get sites like that anymore. So, you know, today it's the $30 million budget and moving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of yards of material. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a different animal.
Yeah. And on top of that, if we examine those three courses, they haven't gone, I mean, obviously they've all done their little bit of changes here and there and tweaks over the years, but there was no massive, you know, massive transition. If we take something like an Oakmont, look what happened to Oakmont, right? Somebody came along and said, you know what, golf needs to be even harder here, so let's fill it full of trees. And then somebody got smart along the way and said, you know what, the Faun, I think it's Founds or Faunus, the Founds brothers, you know, they had it right. We actually, that's not what belongs here. We shouldn't have any of these trees, right? And so they went back to their credit and stripped everything away. But most courses didn't go through that same type of transition. They caught it and they went back, which is remarkable. But those three courses seem to have stood the test of time for the most part. And of course, there's all kinds of tweaks. Like we talk about the back nine at Royal County Down. Greg, I'm sure you played it many times, but it keeps changing. It's still being altered like almost every year. You know, there was a hole that had this weird little water that was, is it 15 or 16 or off the top of my head, you know, you drive semi-blind drive down the hill and there was a very geometrically shaped body of water there in the middle of the fairway. And you think like, what the heck? That's the wrong kind of course. And so they fixed it and changed it, you know, and that hole's actually a really good hole, but it was weird to have water there. Okay. The good guys have to lay up in front of that water. Okay. But this is a links course. What's the water doing there? You know, and now it's been put into like this, you know, a kind of cross bunker to take in mind. So yeah, I think that they recognized the last couple of holes maybe needed some tweaking, and that's a transition that it has been through. But otherwise, there's not that many transitions. Maybe a tee box of a little bit further back or something like that to match the modern game. But generally, they've stood the test of time. As have, you know, your NGLAs and your other ones that generally we would throw into that top 10. I mean, look at Marion. It's always kind of been floating around the top 10.
Sure.
It went through night and day changes. It was completely, I won't go into that quite as much, but it looks a lot different than it did, you know, what is it, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or however long
It was Gil Hans, right?
Yeah. Gil Hans redid that. If you take something like even, you know, we could easily argue that Royal Melbourne is one of the best courses. There's people I know that put it as the best course in the world, Royal Melbourne West. But, you know, they made a change that I didn't love that much. They changed the turf. I mean, that you'd think that's not a big deal, but it was a massive change. And to my knowledge, and I'm sure there's more to it than that, but to my limited knowledge on that subject, they changed it because, you know, they wanted the course to be able to hold up to the modern game. So they put a grass in there that wasn't that was more sticky, a couch grass that was more sticky that didn't allow the ball to roll out 350, you know, basically, so that they could hold the President's Cup and hold other big tournaments and keep it competitive without having to completely change the course.
I just there's something that's reoccurring in the whole experience and discussion we've had is the fact that the idea of being forced to do changes because of professional golf isn't one that actually means you're doing it for the right reasons. And obviously, there's a lot of changes that have been done for professional golf that have resulted in better golf courses, right? I'm not saying that it's a blanket everything, but it depends where your intention is. RCD's intention with the water was to get it to be more in fitting with the golf course, right?
Well, you know, you have to be worried, and we're going to host the Open. I'm in Pinehurst now. We're going to host the Open here in, you know, a couple months. And USGA was in, and John Bodenhammer was in, and, you know, we got to Q&A him a little bit. And, you know, we've got Opens that are scheduled out till almost 2050. And I got to ask him the last question, and I said, okay, unless we're going to buy up the neighborhood, I mean, property, you know, people's homes, you know, because there are a few homes around the certain periphery pieces of number two. Unless we want to buy those houses up, how are we going to keep the modern game, you know, on number two? And he said, we are going to address that. We are going to do something about it. Well, a week later, the ball rollback, you know, was officially announced, which caused, you know, furor again, like it always does. It's probably not far enough. But I mean, you know, and he says, obviously the greens number two will keep the golf course relevant because the greens number two are just, you know, very difficult. But my son and I had played Pinehurst number three, which is not on anybody's top anything list, you know, but it's a fun little golf course, but we play it with hickories. We got to the 18th hole and it's 410 yards uphill. And we stood on the tee with our hickories and said, okay, we can't get there. I mean, it's just no way in hell we can hit two hickory shots uphill on a little bit of a wet day to that green. But we both struck pretty good hickory drives. And I took out my spoon or whatever it was and absolutely mashed it. And I hit it on the green at 410 yards. So I took, I'm playing an old mesh ball with a hickory driver and a hickory spoon. And I can play an uphill 410 yard hole and get there with a mesh ball. Still golf, man. It was every bit as much fun as hitting 16 on number two, you know, with driver seven wood or whatever, which happens occasionally. I had just as much fun hitting those two hickories to a 410 yard hole. So, and with a ball that doesn't go like my Pro V1. So what if we take the ball back? And so what if we play 6,400 yards instead of 7,400 yards? It's still golf. And the accomplishment of hitting two good shots and getting where you wanted to go feels exactly the same, whether the shafts were hickory and the ball was mesh and I'm playing on a short course at Pinehurst or I'm playing number two. And people are so hung up about the fact that, you know, the 350 yard drive. And if we make it only 335, we've ruined the pro game. Come on, man. I'm just not a buyer.
I completely agree. We shouldn't be changing the golf course to suit the pro. It should be the equipment to suit the pro, especially seeing as the equipment is changed every year anyway. Yeah. You know, it's
10 minutes. There's a new something, right?
Yeah.
All with the intention of hitting it further and making golf courses obsolete. I just, you know, that cat is unfortunately out of the bag. But we, you know, if this is a first step of bringing it back in a little bit, I'm a huge fan because I can find a distance with whatever ball or club you give me. I can find a distance to make golf a compelling 4-hour experience. There's doubt about it.
I've got I've got one question to ask you just quickly about Pinehurst. What's number 10 like?
Playing it Sunday. So okay. I've walked nine holes. For the first time. I've walked nine holes of it while it was under construction. There's at least 80 feet of elevation change. Right. It is a wonderful rolling site, very different than any of the other Pinehurst proper golf courses. I've heard it's a tough walk, and I've heard it's pretty good test. A couple days, I'll be out there to see for myself. And what's exciting about it is it's a huge piece of property, and there's room for more. And the golf boom in Pinehurst is off the charts. So, you know, if we can get 10 and 11 built, that's not going to be the world's worst thing for folks coming down here. But very much looking forward to seeing it. But it's a really, really cool piece of property.
It's very exciting because it's Angela Moser's proper welcome to the world.
I think that's just and to build into the speed they built it, is remarkable. You know, obviously we can grow some good grass down here, but I mean, they really did get at that golf course to get it open in time, you know, well, before the Open.
Angela is German, so you expect the German efficiency, right?
I do expect, being German myself, I completely respect and appreciate the German efficiency. But
Angela would not mind me saying this, I'm sure, but trust me, she's done everything in her power to make it as less like a German course as possible.
Fair enough. No, it's a cool piece of ground though, man. I mean, when you stand out there and look at it and you get to, you know, eight's going to be the kind of controversy hole. They left the spoils that you kind of hit the ball over with, and the green's kind of tucked in a la Tobacco Roads par five. And then you get to nine and you look uphill, or, you know, 9, 10, you know, that just chases up this big hill. I've heard some folks just say, I don't know how I'm going to walk it. You know, I think the caddies are going to get a real workout on number 10 from the early reviews. So, but check back. We're on the tee on Sunday. So I'm super excited.
I'm looking forward to hearing from it.
So one thing that I wanted to just jump back to really quickly, because Greg, you're talking about hickories and playing it the course a little bit differently, even though that was a 410 yard one. That was one of the really interesting things that you read through in Jasper's take and, you know, transition of Augusta, is that when you read through the intention that a lot of those holes, I don't want to say all of them, right, but the holes were developed with or designed with, a lot of them were designed with a running shot in mind. And again, I don't know when you played, and you play at Pinehurst, and there's a lot of running game going on, especially if you're playing in the wintertime down there.
Certainly.
But that's an Augusta that I don't know. I've never seen that, right? So that transition obviously had to do with the ball and the clubs and the game, but now it's like you shoot at the pin, you know.
It's an aerial, completely an aerial golf course. No two ways about it. Unapologetically, I mean, it just is what, you know, it is that now, for sure. But I certainly never saw it or have no understanding of if there would have been a real ground game option, you know, back in the earlier iterations. I don't have any knowledge on that.
Yeah. Do you know why it was originally a ground game course? Because Mackenzie and Jones became friends over their love for the old course, and a lot of the holes on the Augusta are actually Mackenzie's
templates.
Well, I think Mackenzie would shoot you for saying template, but ideal holes, they're his example of an ideal hole. I think there's someone referenced template holes or copying holes, and at was it Moortown to Mackenzie, and Mackenzie, because they thought he'd copied the Redan for his one hole that he designed for Moortown. And he got completely, wasn't too happy with the reporter.
Influenced by, I'll change that. I won't say that he copied templates.
Here's the deal. If you were building a golf course tomorrow, tell me, I know the first thing I would copy, and I would copy it to the foot, is the pit at North
Island Island Green at Sawgrass.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's definitely what I would not copy.
Totally kidding.
But the little green on the other side of the little rock fence at North Berwick is, you know, just one of the most epic little holes that you'll ever play in your life. And I would steal the boulders if I built a golf course, and I would copy the pit in a heartbeat. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. They built an amazing hole that you see nowhere else in the world. And so what if you get to play it someplace else? I have no problem with a template hole. I think it's great. And especially the Oman.
I'm very fortunate, Greg, to be a member at North Berwick. And I only live 15 minutes away. So
I'll be over in July. I don't have a tee time. I don't even have time for a tee time. But I wish I'd have known this about 3 months ago. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, and Greg, the other thing is I've been waiting for years for an invite from him. And
we have a
text message about it.
We have a new goal here.
Just tell me when I'll book the tee time. But I tell you one thing. Is if you've got a medal card going, and this goes back to all that tournament golf chat we've been talking about, what defines a golf course. If you have a medal card going and you find yourself against the wall, you want a sledgehammer. The last thing you want is to be sitting, because you can easily just be resting up against that wall. I've putted off the wall, back off, to be able to chip over it.
What is it? Is it cross three, James? Is the stone fence cross number three?
Yeah.
Okay. So my little one was I think 12 when he played it the first time, and he hit it okay, but he did hit it real high in the air. And he banged three balls in a row off that fence that came right back at him. And I've never seen a little boy so upset with life as he couldn't get the ball over the fence on 12. And we've laughed about that for absolutely forever. So you know what? If you're against the fence, take a drop, move on with life. It's okay.
No, I'm completely with you. It's just I love it. I think it's one of the great reasons you want to play North Berwick, because very rarely you have to flop it over a wall to a small pit green. That is remarkable how they can keep that green in the condition they do. Because
it's one of the greatest little holes in the game, without a doubt.
My main reason, James, is just to be able to say that I've beaten James Henderson at his home course. That is probably the biggest one.
Well,
looking forward to that day, David.
I'll have to take you to Gullen as well. That's where my handicap's held.
Oh, no. Okay, well.
So just before we finish, because I think we've kind of covered it all, I always like to ask every guest, David, you've had this question before, but I want to hear, we're talking about fun, right? We've talked about it a lot in the aspect of a golf course and how important it is when you're rating a golf course. What's your five? It doesn't have to be five. Just name what comes to mind first. Five favorite golf courses. The ones that just come to your mind when you think, okay, like Ely's one for me. I love Ely. I just Ely's enjoy great. Being. But Ely's your five favorites.
Wow. I don't think I've ever been asked that, James. I've been asked a lot of questions before.
And it's not the best.
No, I get it. Five favorites. I've already been an admitted Dornick fan. So Dornick is one of my favorites just because I just love it. Prairie Dunes, my jumpers, you know, I love Prairie Dunes. Broa in Scotland, I think, is just an absolute treat to everything that's great about the game. I don't know, James. I'm gonna hear David's five. I gotta think more on the other two.
Well, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I'm gonna opt out because I've probably answered it several times and I can't remember what I said before, so I don't want
to. I was actually trying to see if you'd screw up because I could go back and
saying something different than I said last time.
But no, I mean it's just fun to play places that are fun, that are interesting, and whatever. I'm a greens guy. So, you know, the courses that I really, really love all have, you know, I play number two quite a bit and, you know, the greens are just beguiling, you know, which is fun. My home course for 25 years in Chicago, Flossmoor, has just got a set of absolutely magical greens that fall in every direction imaginable, including away from the line of play a number of times, you know, and I just think, you know, ground game and the ball rolls away from the line of the hole. I mean, it's just, you know, nobody brills that anymore. Right. And I just really enjoy seeing different things, you know, this perched up two bunkers here off the ground, can't roll anything up stuff is just completely boring to me. But this lay of the land and, you know, greens that, you know, look like they don't have any break. And, you know, we got putts at Flossmoor that'll break 40 feet, you know, and it looks like it would break two. And if you hit the apex, the ball goes in a hole, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff is what evokes fun in the game. And so I'm just a big fan of some stuff like that, that, you know, doesn't mean it's world 100, but boy, it's, you know, it's always a good time.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Absolutely. That's why North Berwick's climbed rankings. It's beautiful there, but the reason it's climbed rankings is because you're playing shots that you just never thought you'd have to play.
Never see anywhere else. And Berwick is high up on that list of fun. I mean, it's just one of those just cool places from the first swing until you try not to hit a car on 18 on the way home. You know, I mean, it's just fun.
Well, talking about template holes, I've been doing a wee bit of research, and I was standing because there's a historian who I was at North Berwick with, who turned to me when we were walking outside the clubhouse, and I was describing the fact that the 18th of North Berwick is just the 18th of St Andrews, but 75 yards shorter. And the guy turned to me and went, you know, old Tom Morris did this one first. So my argument was, if that's true, does that mean that the first ever template hole was the 18th at North Berwick and the 18th at St Andrews is the first ever template?
I've never heard of old Tom associated with Berwick before. So that just in and of itself is good. I thought God did Berwick. So I didn't know anybody got any credit for any of those holes.
I think old Tom let God do his work and he just put his name on it.
I tell you what, good play. Seriously, good play.
Could be. Gentlemen, I need to jump onto another call, actually. So I definitely have to go. Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Fabulous to have you on the pod and discuss this, hot topic right before the Masters is coming.
No, it's great. It's great to hang out with you guys and just talk goofy golf stuff. And probably 90% of what we both said, people will disagree with wholeheartedly. So it's all good. It's just fun.
Greg, one thing I'd like to ask you to do is your website. How would someone if they wanted to get your book, what would the website be?
James, I appreciate that. It's globalgolftravelswithanass.com. It was a fun little project. Almost sold out of the first production run. My wife asked me, she said, after you've played all this golf all over the world, spent all this money, how much more money are we going to lose on your book project? And so, happy to say that I do not have a garage full of books anymore. It's really gone fun. And I just want to make one quick plug, if I may, is my good friend Bob McCoy, who was the guy that played the World 100 in 100 consecutive days, just published his book. I think he called it The Real McCoy, but Bob publishes a little blog called The Odyssey that he's had out for a long time. And I think he just went to publish in Bob's story of playing the World 100 in 100 consecutive days back when there were no cell phones and no internet to do it. Is a really good story too. So I just while I'm at it, I got to give Bob a shout out because without his help, I wouldn't have finished. So
Bob's a huge friend of Top 100 and helps us a lot and stuff like that. So yeah, absolutely. We should tag both those James and
100%.
That would be great. And I got to run, guys. Thanks so much.
Yep.
Thank you very David, much, David. See you. And thank you very much, Greg. Very special thank you to Greg Orndorff and David Davis for coming on to discuss the key features that we don't actually want to talk about when we're doing ratings of golf courses. It's so important to people understand that we're talking about the bones of the golf course and that's what makes it good, not its upkeep. It's everything that fits around it. So thank you very much for coming on. It means a lot to me to get that point across so people understand that. And if you want to discuss the topic, go on to our Instagram, official Top 100, or give me an email at james@top100golfcourses.com. Thank you very much for listening. And remember, play fast, lunch slow.